Okay, guys, welcome. This panel is organized as part of the Climate Change Journalism class, Ideas and Transformations. The students here are from all over Europe. We have an American and a Chinese student here as well. And they have been given the task of thinking of what is climate change journalism and what can it become. So we all organized this panel as food for thought for the students. There's also some members of the staff for the Institute of Journalism and Media Studies here. And I'll do a little bit of introduction to the camera here as well. It was in the Christmas of 1896, the Swede scientist in Stockholm, Svante Arrhenius, was suffering from a divorce. And he was sitting with his pencil, just doing the calculus of what would be the effect of more CO2 in the atmosphere. And by the way, those models that he made that Christmas turned out to be not too bad with time. In the Christmas just before 2014, the editor of The Guardian newspaper was having a little bit of a melancholy moment. I'm here going to quote here from the book that Alan Rusbridger writes, Breaking News, Remaking Journalism, Why It Matters Now. I had been sitting by a log fire, glass of wine in my hand, wondering about regrets. I had just announced I would be stepping down as editor. What would I miss? What could we have done better? Maybe it was the unseasonably mild weather outside, but my thoughts turned to climate change. Even the best-intentioned news organizations struggle with the subject. Welcome, Alan Rusbridger. For natural and human reasons, Svante Arrhenius could not be part of the panel today, but I'm very happy to have you here. I want to ask you first the nature of your regrets. I mean, you were the editor for The Guardian newspaper, one of the papers I read vividly for its environmental coverage. What was it specifically that you regretted when it came to your coverage of climate change? What would you like to do differently?
Well, hello, everybody, and it's very nice to be here. It comes to the heart of what journalism thinks it's doing. So if we think that climate change is the biggest subject of our generation, which it probably is, because it's the sort of big existential threat to our species, and if journalism aspires to inform people about things that really matter, then you would expect journalism to cover climate change equally large. You know, you would think something this important would be in the front pages all the time, being discussed on news bulletins. And I'm afraid that doesn't happen, or it doesn't happen in the papers I read. In fact, it's worse than that. Not only is it that much is written about it. Even that much tends to be in the hands of people who are quite skeptical about the whole subject. So I think that somehow, and we can speculate as to why, there's a failure of journalism. And it wasn't that The Guardian had done badly. I just thought, should we have done better?
Mm. And what did you come up with in terms of doing something different? Because you did launch a campaign.
Yeah, well, we had long discussion trying to work out why. And, one of the reasons is that people don't want to be, they're bored with reading about it, or they're frightened about reading about it, or they're happy to read about it, but it feels like something they can't have any influence over. And so they feel fatalistic about it. It's just something that's going to happen. There's nothing I can do in my life. So we thought, should we do a campaign rather than just reporting, or as well as reporting? And then we thought, well, what kind of campaign could we do? We didn't want to do a meaningless campaign. And we didn't want to do a sort of tiny little campaign, switch your lights off earlier this evening or share a bath or all the things that, or don't use so many plastic bags. So we decided to look at the money that goes into fossil fuels and whether we could persuade people to divest from fossil fuels.
Mm. Yeah. So that was back then, right? And you mentioned it in 2014, you talked about the unseasonable mild weather. Looking back from the last 4 years, there's been a number of kind of records, and we've had this extreme summer of 2018 going into the hurricane season and so on. Do you see any changes in the coverage since? Beyond The Guardian, is there more of an emphasis on this now, do you think?
I think there are some signs of hope. So, I mean, Britain's just had the longest, hottest summer since whenever. And I think people began to get a bit frightened. And The Sun, which is the biggest mass market tabloid, which in the past would have said, this is great, you know, we can all have barbecues, you know, we can have lovely suntans. Actually, there was something in the tone of The Sun that began to say, they did a big front page map saying this was the hottest year in history. And so I think there's something in people's experience of weather. I mean, the problem with those events that you've just mentioned is that it's very hard to get climate scientists to come out and say, yes, that terrible hurricane or that terrible flood or this terrible drought is due to climate change. Mm. And that's partly the press's fault, because we've beaten them up so much in the past as we would claim, I'm saying we, exaggerating their case, that they're now very, very cautious, which makes it harder for journalists to, you can't say, well, you know, this summer is because of climate change or that hurricane is because of climate change.
Yeah, I was just listening to watching the U.S. Open on the television now in September, and they were going endlessly on about the heat and how they might have to change the Grand Slams in the future. Yeah. But there seemed to be this kind of line that you do not cross in terms of suggesting this broader climate context for the heating. Is that caution that you're talking about, is that still there also within newspapers and
media? Well, I think
the
there's
media?
Still a strong denial streak. In a way, it's sort of got caught up in broader culture wars. So generally, if you're right-wing or a sort of neoliberalist right-winger, You're scornful of climate change. I mean, there's a huge generalization. Generally, people on the left think it's real. So in Britain, generally, the right-wing papers, which are pretty big and influential, have either not covered it or covered it in a very skeptical way. And in my book, there's a man in Britain called James Dellingpole, who I waste some words on. So he is a character who is an English literature graduate from Oxford. So he doesn't claim to be scientifically trained, but he is the climate change correspondent of Breitbart, which is actually an influential place to be, because you know you're likely to be read by the president. And you sort of think, well, that's fine, you know, go and write your nonsense on Breitbart. But if you type his name into a search engine, I found 60 references in the last couple of years where he'd been writing for the mainstream press, you know, The Spectator, The Telegraph, The Daily Mail, The Sun, The Express. He's the sort of go-to guy. And this is what ties it back into journalism, because if our story as journalists is that we're doing something better than the internet, then why would we use James Dellingpole, you know? Because that's not, it's not painting an accurate picture of life. It's just, you know, we can't claim to be better than the internet if that's how we behave.
Yeah, but you mentioned The Sun front page, you know, in terms, you know, that this summer, and it was almost this kind of alarmist note from The Sun, the Murdoch press, which is, I guess, is a bit of a novelty. Do you see a way that climate change can come from this kind of bottom tiny section to becoming more mainstream, and if so, how could that happen?
Well, one of the influential moments which I write about in the book was meeting Bill McKibben, who's a climate change campaigner. He's got an organization called 360 Degrees. He's a former journalist. And we'd both been given an award in Stockholm, and we hung around together for a couple of days. And he said, look, the mistake you're making, Alan, you have great environmental journalists, but you've put climate change into a sort of an environmental ghetto over there. And that's how you're covering it. And it's got to get out of that ghetto. It's not a environmental story any longer. It's a story about security. It's a story about food. It's a story about farming. It's a story about immigration. It's a story about water. And so each one of your correspondents ought to have climate change as part of their mindset, because I thought that was very wise, because actually if you label it climate change, probably you're going to put off a lot of people who won't want to read about it. If you say, well, actually, if you think immigration is bad at the moment, you know, if you care about immigration, I can probably, it's going to be 10 times worse in 20 years' time as people have to flee areas that are no longer sustainable. That's one way of doing it.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's a good way of introducing the next panelist here, because Bodil is Åslaug Dotter Nordsletten is the entire name. You are the current editor of Farmer's Friend in Norway. And you've been dealing with one issue that's been going on, the state of agriculture. Have you thought about this relationship between, on the one hand, farming as the concrete issue and the broader climate context? How do you think about that?
I struggle with this every issue, every week, because farming has everything to do with climate. Climate has everything to do with farming. But if I write about climate change as such and not integrated into every article, I meet the dilemma of readers, you know, falling off, because there's a lot. There is still, unfortunately, a large degree of skepticism among farmers. It's not to say that they're climate deniers, because they just have to deal with the climate anyhow, whether there's a drought or flooding. But we also tend to compartmentalize the issue. You have this question at the end of a story, for example: what about climate change? How do you adapt? You know, when actually the whole story, more or less, is about last season, how you coped. We don't call it climate change all the time, and it's a challenge.
But how do you prepare then, Alan, the editorial team for such an issue? I mean, the media crisis is an obvious thing, is something that you write about in the book. In the U.S., there's a long history where they fire science journalists, they fire environmental specialists of sorts. And the arguments among some editors has been that, well, precisely, journalists should be generalists. They should just be able to pick climate change as any part of their beat. So how do you see, you know, preparing the newspaper industry of the day, the relationship between, on the one hand, specializing, getting the knowledge about climate change, and on the other hand, being kind of generalists that could pick the climate change dimension from a story on, say, farming or transport or whatever. So what's your thought on that?
Well, one of the problems is that specialisms are dying out. So, all papers in Britain would have at one point have had a defence correspondent, an agricultural correspondent, a church correspondent, a prison, and they were very knowledgeable people. And we had three or four people with PhDs who were writing about science and the environment. And it's very difficult to sustain that kind of staff now. I'm sometimes just now as a listener, I'm an insomniac, I can't sleep at night, so I listen to the radio, which is quite scary now, because I listen to the news, and the news is generally not good. And sometimes you will listen to stories of drought, or stories of war, or stories of famine, or stories of immigration, and you think, actually, this is all the same story. This is actually all about climate change. And yet the BBC is treating them as four different stories. And so we could begin by trying to sort of draw some threads together and trying to say, well, actually, there is a link behind all these. And I think, I mean, there was a story in the summer about the crisis in Australian farming, which was just terrifying. You know, there is they can't grow any grass, so there's nothing for the cattle to eat. And so they're having to move the cattle inside, and they're trying now to get rid of the cattle. So the whole sort of food system is beginning to break down. And I think, you know, at that point you think, well, surely people are going to start reading about that.
Yeah, that happens, and you get reports about hunger and other issues. But what is it that makes that last step of kind of giving the background of climate change so kind of difficult? You mentioned that it was partly the readers, you know, will they be put off? But are there occasions where you think it's wise to give that broader context as well, even in news stories?
Of climate change happening?
Yeah,
of course. And I think also, although the story from Australia this summer was extreme, I mean, farmers breaking down and losing their livelihood, you had some version of that in Norway as well. Several farmers in Norway had to start slaughtering their livestock way early because of the lack of fodder. And you will probably see this crisis living on throughout the winter and next spring. You know, where are they going to get their grass from? And we had farmers on national television crying. That doesn't happen often. And there was actually a lot of media reports on the drought in Norway this summer. And as you said, I think, you know, some people woke up, and they're starting to see, hopefully, this broader picture of drought, climate change, affecting farmers first and foremost, then the food system, then the local economy, then the regional economy, and basically it's a question of national security and of food safety, and among some among some people, I think, you know, that was a realization after this summer.
Just another question here. I mean, there's also the question about the pessimism and the optimism. As the climate debate has developed over the last decade, the interest in climate psychology, how do people respond to the news? You know, do they want more negative news? So within climate psychology and climate communication, there's a stress that you should tell more positive stories and less negative stories. You know, tell three positive stories for one negative one is a slogan by one climate psychologist in Norway. What's your take on this, Alan, in terms of the negative aspects, the positive aspects in climate change coverage?
If that's true, and I think there's a psychologist called George Marshall who's written about this, who says that actually that there's real fear. You know, I would be frightened to read your stories about Norwegian farmers. and so people are looking at the brain and seeing the brain cortex sort of closes down because people don't want to read about this stuff. So if that's true, then maybe you're right. Maybe you should write about more positive stories. And also part of what we did with the campaign was to say, well, actually, if you have a pension or you have savings, or you're a member of a church or a college finance committee, you can do something about this, and you can withdraw the money. And we did the thing that is very unfair. We targeted the liberals. We thought there's no point.
Bill Gates.
We went for Bill Gates because Bill Gates is actually a miraculous human being and gives away stunning sums of money for health. But at the same time, climate change is the biggest threat to health, and he had something like £1 billion invested in fossil fuels. So, you know, we put the heat on, as it were, put the heat on Bill Gates, and he didn't crumble immediately, but a year later he withdrew his investments, and that's not going to sort of change things overnight. But actually, this thing happened that we thought we were making a kind of moral case that fossil fuels were like tobacco or they were like arms. And if you were a church or a school, you wouldn't want to have your money in them. But actually the case that the city woke up to was that we can't burn all this stuff. We have something like five times more fossil fuels in the ownership of countries and state and private and companies than we can possibly burn and still stay within 2 degrees. So this term, stranded assets, you know. So the city then began to reevaluate companies and say, well, if this company can't burn 3/5 of its assets, then why is that company worth this? And I think that's how you begin to get change. But it was positive because it made people feel they could do something.
Yeah. I asked the students also to come with some questions, and I have one from Pierluca, from Italy. He was reading on Naomi Klein's book, which I know also writing quite a bit for The Guardian. And she says something to the effect that because the power of the fossil fuel companies, also climate policies has been developed very much and shaped by the fossil fuel companies. And your divestment campaign, of course, is an instance. Why did you kind of choose that kind of Bill McKibben as your campaign? Was that precisely to find some kind of concrete target that you did that?
Well, he did this. If you haven't read, there's a wonderful piece by Bill McKibben in Rolling Stone about 5 years ago, which is just the maths of climate change, which sounds like a forbidding subject, but it's actually, there are only 3 figures. And once you've got those 3 figures, which nobody can test, by the way, then you understand. And so that was a sort of terribly easy thing to present to the public. You say, well, actually, it is, we can't burn this stuff because we'll never stay, that whole stranded asset argument. And everybody gets that. It's a very simple journalistic story to go with. And then you say, well, what are we going to do about it? And trillions of dollars have since been divested. And it's not going to stop Shell in their tracks. But we did, you know, we did a podcast with the chief executive of Shell, Ben Van Beurden, who began by agreeing with those figures, and then saying, well, okay, so let's have a discussion.
Okay, I know you have to go, and I'm going to invite soon up the other two panelists, but I have one question that I want to have as a cliffhanger for the latter part of the discussion, which is, this is part of the Institute of Journalism and Media Studies at Oslo Metropolitan University, and we're having a discussion of how can we, teaching future journalists about climate change, if you went back to school and you were to give some advice on how we would make sure that we didn't regret after a period of time the way we taught our students, well, did you have any input for that?
Well, I think my generation of journalists was a very literary generation, so you did English at university, then if you weren't very brainy or talented, you became a journalist because, you could write, so then you... And that was fine, but I think people who can do data, do you teach them all data? Just being really fantastic with data and working out how to visualize data, I think is a fantastically valuable skill, because in the end, if people are not going to be persuaded by words, they will be persuaded by data. And the Al Gore film, the work that Hans Rosling did, which is, it's just so sort of convincing, really.
Okay, thank you so much, Alan, for answering our question and coming here. I know you're launching or talking about your book later today, so somebody might come there, but let's give Alan a round of applause. So, Anders, I want to start with you. You have just written 2 long stories on climate change after this summer. First of all, because our students they don't read Norwegian. So could you just kind of summarize, what have you been working with in the last couple of months?
So the first story was sort of sparked by... I missed a story in the summer that I missed reading because I was on holiday and it was 30 degrees. Days on end, and I was just walking around thinking, when are somebody going to do the climate change story to the both the heat waves in Norway and also the heat waves on, in the northern hemisphere, and then nobody did. So I came back at work in the start of August and started working on originally not a very large piece about the heat waves and what the climate science is was telling about the relation to climate change. And then it sort of felt more severe, and New York Times dropped a huge piece about climate change. And I felt that I just wanted to do something with a bit more punch. So I scaled it up and interviewed, I think I did 25 interviews for the story. 12 climate scientists, politicians from all parties, and then people from the agriculture and sort of governmental offices. And it ended up being maybe a bit of a pessimistic story about where we are now.
Yeah, because the title was called Scorched Earth.
Yeah. It was like first part of it was telling about the heat waves in the summer, and then the climate scientists were looking ahead to the future, and they were also pretty pessimistic about what things are looking like. And the second one was about the arguments of the Norwegian oil and gas industry and how they talk about their own role in a future consistent with the Paris Agreement. So it was kind of trying to take them seriously and follow the arguments and see if it holds up.
And you're now working on a third part of the series. Can you tell me a little bit about that?
Yeah. It's about the gap of between what we are doing now and what we need to be doing in order to first the 2 degrees target, which is a really ambitious target, and then the 1.5 degree target, which most scientists view as really, really unrealistic. And a huge part of all the scenarios that takes us to the Paris targets involve something called negative emissions, which means scraping carbon out of the atmosphere in a huge scale. And that point seemed to have been largely overlooked in the climate debate. But the way we are living now makes it absolutely essential that we manage to like get the technology to do that and scale it up. And so it's just, I want to just bring some light on that topic and to say that this, we're not on track here, and the work we need to do is hugely, it's gigantic. And it's going to be hard.
Yeah. But this has not just been your individual stories. You know, when we read the story, we can see that this is part of the Dagblad editorial teams, and that they're going for climate change journalism. You said. Can you tell me a little bit about why you could even do this? Because you're doing long format journalism. You know, as you mentioned, 25 interviews. This is not the ordinary news beat for you. So they were set aside some resources for you to do that. Can you tell me a little about how Dagblad as a paper thought about that?
Yeah. For those of you who don't know the newspaper, it's a liberal left wing newspaper, and climate has been an important subject for our editorial board over the last couple of years, especially our political editor writes a lot about climate change. And then our former editor-in-chief, he wanted to have other kind of resources in the climate change coverage. So we wanted to have at least one dedicated reporter working on climate change just all the time. And I was lucky to get an opportunity and started in April. Hopefully I'm going to continue next year.
Yeah.
We'll see.
Yeah. I'm going to have a question for you, and then with Botil can also turn to afterwards, because as I mentioned, the title of your series is Scorched Earth, you know, and from the discussion that we had with Alan Rusbridger, you know, that sense that there's just all these negative stories and maybe we should find something positive. But the readership of that first story was quite good, I understand.
Yeah, it's one of the most read stories I've ever written. And it was, as you say, pessimistic or negative. But
so what do you think of that? I mean, didn't you feel persuaded to kind of, you know, choose the positive angle in a sense? Why would you continue with it, with that kind of negative framing of the story?
I don't look at myself or my role as a motivator. My role as a reporter is to hold the power accountable and also to inform. And if the outlook is dire, we as journalists need to inform the public about that, even if it looks worse than you think. Because if you're not aware of the magnitude of the problem and the seriousness, both the seriousness of the consequences of the warming itself, but also the way society has to cope to try to limit it as much as possible. If you're not aware of the scale and the magnitude of the problem, how can you then make the decisions that we need to get there?
Mm. Yeah, I know you have some opinions on this as well, Bodil. Well, what do you think about the positive versus the negative or the realistic of what, you know, when you convey the climate change dimension as a journalist, how do you go about it?
We don't, in my paper, we don't write so much about climate change and the science behind that as such. We put it into the everyday practical life of the farmer, be it about how you harvest your hay, your grass, or you store your manure. But I think this is a huge dilemma because I am one of those who have also, you know, who is convinced about the dire straits that we're in. I don't think we're headed in the right direction. I think we're looking the end of the world as we know it in the eye, which doesn't mean the end of the world, full stop, but it's that we're approaching something pretty dramatic. And on top of that, my newspaper is known among its readership to always choose that constructive angle, because there's so much shit coming the farmer's way anyway. So, you know, you have to write in such a way that they will, you know, keep on being farmers and have, you know, have someone shed some light and happiness on their day. And unfortunately, the climate story isn't very happy. So I struggle with that all the time. And then we choose often to, you know, the practical angle. What could you do? What can be done in the future? Not to save the world, but to get through the day with a minimum footprint.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. So returning a little bit to that kind of the everyday lives of farmers, I saw on the news yesterday that the apple farmers in Norway look set. They can do a pretty good, they have a pretty good harvest coming along now because of this drought summer. So sometimes it will be negative, sometimes it will be positive. But how do you kind of keep that climate change dimension to it present in your newspaper as these ups and downs of everyday lives go on with the farmers?
Well, for us it's been pretty easy because our main readership is on the south and west coast, in the really big producing areas, some of them at least. And you have to write about climate all the time because last year rained away. There was rain every day. And this year we had scorched earth. We really had scorched earth, both here around Oslo and specifically in the southern part of the country. So it seeps into absolutely every article that we write. But since there's also a bumper harvest on potatoes and apples, to be very concrete, then we write about the happiness, you know, surrounding the farmers that are in that business as well. But I'm very aware of, I mean, we had a report in 2010 concluding that climate change overall will be beneficial for Norwegian agriculture because the temperature will grow up and we will have bigger harvests. Now we need a new report that because this proves not to be the case. Yes, we will have a higher temperature, but it will still be pitch dark through, you know, most of the year as it is up here. And it will be even more rain than the 20% extra that we've gotten the last 100 years. So no, climate change won't be good for Norway. That is the underlying story, even when my readers and farmers would like to hear the positive story. And as Naomi Klein says, you know, this changes everything. maybe not this year, maybe not in 2 years, but the loss of biodiversity, for example, that follows with it, it will have consequences on some particular harvests. The weather, the rain, and so on.
Yeah.
So that is the...
I want to introduce Stan to the discussion here as well. I mean, obviously, this discussion about how journalism deals with climate change is also reflected in our at our department. You know, how do a journalism education or media and communication teach climate change? So given this idea that climate change is a dimension of other stories, you know, how do you see climate change as a dimension from the point of view as head of the department here?
First of all, I think there is an at least in our journalism program, where one of the basic skills we try to teach our journalism students is ways of doing critical thinking, ways of critically assessing sources, and sort of that critical mindset you need as a journalist. I think climate change is a field which lends itself really well to that kind of teaching, because it is a field in which the whole what is a fact and what is an opinion can be quite messy, and where you have lots of people sort of stating opinions about what's actually a fact. So if we can sort of use, that's why it's a great sort of case to use when we teach our journalism students about critical thinking. Like every journalism student should know that when Donald Trump says, "I don't believe that climate change is made by human activity," then every journalism student should ideally know that you can't have an opinion on that. That's a fact, idiot. I mean, to sort of be able to recognize what is actually, what do we know, what is sort of, what can be considered certain knowledge on this topic, and what is sort of legit, what is it legitimate to have an opinion on. To make, be able to make that distinction is really important regarding climate change, and it's sort of, it should be a basic skill in the ways journalism students do critical thinking. So that's one aspect. And also, I think Alan Rusbridge said a lot of things that made really sense also for us as a journalism education and as a Department of Journalism and Media Studies. First of all, like, used the phrase that in The Guardian that climate change journalism has sort of been left to the environmental ghetto. And sort of, it should really be a dimension or something that every journalist has in the back of their mind somehow, like to the same extent as gender issues, at least to some extent, has sort of been sort of part of the general mindset. Like if you see a new government presented with only men, every journalist who's not totally stupid would sort of have a instinct on sort of making that part of the news, that why are there only men in this government. And in the same way, sort of, if there are obvious environmental or climate change issues related to some story, then it should be sort of natural for every journalist student to sort of pick up on that instinct and sort of follow
up. Yeah, but that you seem then to suggest that if the, some of the really important journalistic skills, critical mindset, if those things are in place, then you would also be able to discover climate change for the big dimension or issue that it is. Is there a kind of need for specialized kind of teaching to it, or should we integrate it within those kind of classical journalistic skills and values and norms?
I think we need to do both, and it's important to do both, because it needs to be part of the general education of every journalist to be aware and to sort of be able to ask the right questions. But we also need specialists, because it is a complicated topic, and there's lots of research that the general journalist would not necessarily be aware of, that you would need some sort of special competence to sort of know about and to be able to recognize. So I think we need both.
Yeah. Anders, you told me that your kind of basic teaching on climate change was fairly recent, you know, like before April or something this year. You hadn't worked a lot with climate change issues.
No.
So that is a bit.
I was aware of the.
Yeah, you were aware of it, you know. But I think it's. Can you just tell me a little bit more of that process? Because you've been an investigative journalist. So I mean, you're really gone that school, of looking for stories. You know, as you mentioned yourself, the power and so on and so forth. So can you tell us a little about your process of kind of, you know, why did you choose to use your time on this?
I just think it's a fascinating story.
Yeah.
I read someone, I think it was an American reporter, and he spoke of it as not just like a story, but the story, and essentially also a deeply human story. It's not detached from everyday life. It's an integrated part of it for every single human being.
Yeah.
And it's going to affect the whole of society for the rest of my lifetime. So obviously I think that it's a fascinating field to cover. But I think it's quite fascinating, the debate about what kind of skills you would need to be a climate change reporter. And I think basically it's the same skills as you would need to report on any other topic. You need to be, first of all, curious and have a sense of what's a good story, and then you figure out who could be the sources, and you check your facts and you write the story. The knowledge of the issue itself will come after a while. I didn't go and study climate change before I started doing climate change reporting, but over the past couple of months I can definitely I can spot stories that a lot of my other colleagues won't, because they don't see all how dots are connected. So it's that aspect as well. But it shouldn't be viewed as something very different from other topics that you go out to report on. It's basically doing the job as a reporter, and skills comes after a while.
I agree with both of you that, you know, both as human beings and as students of journalism, you need to be to refine that ability to think critically. But if you report on climate, which is the story, I totally agree, then you also have to be self-critical in the sense that, you know, what got us here? We spoke about this earlier today. What got us at this point in history where we are? It is a narrative that humanity has completely immersed itself in, that we go for growth. Everything is growth. And if you accept that we have to be critical to that narrative, then you will also start asking different questions. You will also be much more critical when you report on the so-called solutions to climate change, the techno fixes, the Teslas, the what have you. There are no quick fix. There is no silver bullet. And I think you need to internalize that criticism to the very story that we have been telling ourselves throughout the ages that everything is going to get better, that there is a silver lining over there. That is a fundamentally flawed history that also underpins a lot of our journalism as we chase after the happy stories.
Yeah. And the change to that narrative, I mean, if we are to believe some of the reports coming out in terms of, you know, like just the last couple of weeks, the chief of the UN talking about we have 2 years left. Anders, you mentioned that the 1.5 degree report coming out later and so on. So if we take the kind of parallels then that you mentioned in terms of kind of gender awareness, we have about 40 years at least where the struggle for women's liberation and so on has at least helped us come to a point where we can have Me Too campaigns and we could speed up history a little bit. How could we kind of inject some of that kind of climate change spinal cord fast enough? You know, do we not need kind of special kind of courses, special teachings, take the editorial teams, you know, and have a day out at school and talk about this? Could we kind of just rely on that the gut instincts of journalism would kind of take us to the stories that Anders has been telling us?
No, we can't just rely on that, but It's a difficult question, but I believe very much in sort of the power of examples that we as teachers use when we do teaching. How do we teach about these basic journalistic skills, like source criticism and what is a news story and so forth? What are the examples we then draw upon? And what are the sort of the topics that we relate those basic skills to? So that's to sort of to have climate change issues come up as sort of a recurring set of examples taken from that field would be at least a good way to sort of implement that this is sort of kind of a naturally occurring topic that would sort of pop up whenever you deal with these issues as a journalist, if we sort of talk about it a lot in classes, and not in classes sort of specially assigned for climate change as a topic, but in those basic classes where we teach basic journalism skills.
Yeah, like the fact and opinion that you mentioned, exactly. You are just finishing this course. Do you have any kind of advice or things to think about for these students sitting here? Anders, first of all.
I think the word climate change is being used here in every other sentence during this session, which is natural. And the first kind of connotation to climate change would be the Earth is getting warmer. So you would think that all your journalism on climate change would be about the world getting warmer. But I would just advise you to keep in mind that climate change reporting can be so much else than the basic science of carbon going up in the atmosphere and the temperature following. It's the way our energy system is set up, it's technology, it's farming, at least food security, could be all the way down to local small businesses doing something clever. Don't use climate change to sort of like narrow down the perspective of what your reporting should be on. It's just, you could write about basically anything as a climate change reporter, and you will find a strong link to it in a lot of stories. So, yeah.
Anything, and not at least farming, because climate change, again, has everything to do also with farming. And whereas there are a lot of climate journalists out there, there are very few skilled journalists writing about agriculture. It's an incredibly complex field, even by Norwegian small-scale standards. It's an incredibly complex field. And should you choose to write about climate change as part of agriculture or vice versa, you'll never run out of a job. And my advice to you would be to pick up on both climate change, of course, and agriculture as a way of telling people that, you know, we need to change our ways. And as Anders said, it's food, it's the human stories, it's hardcore, in my view, it's hardcore security politics. It's very local, and it's all human and global. So you'll never be unemployed.
No, I have two comments I would like to make. Yeah. One is something that Alan Respiter said, yeah, which I found interesting, and which I hadn't quite thought of before, because there has been a problem in climate change journalism, at least before, that it has been difficult to visualize and difficult to sort of get massive attention to the stories because it's not very visual. But now during the summer, of course, it's been much more visual. But what you said about data visualizations and sort of using those new tools for visualizing data on climate change issues is a very good idea. And the second point I would like to make is you had this discussion earlier on positive versus negative coverage or angles. I don't like that dichotomy at all. And I think we need to move beyond that dichotomy. And I think it is important. And this is a bit in line with the whole movement, the constructivist journalism movement. But it is important not only to sort of point out the problems, but also, as you said, sort of critically assess the solutions and also take on a responsibility as journalists to sort of look at the possible solutions in a critical manner and to make that part of the journalism and not only sort of leave it at now I've described the problem, someone else has to deal with how to deal with this problem. So and that goes beyond, that's not positive versus negative, that's something else.
Exactly, yeah. Well, I want to thank all three of you for taking part in the discussion, and we will finish now. Let's give them a round of applause.